I'm Bill Quine. May I welcome you to this recording by Peel Heritage Trust. On the 26th of April 2011, we held a tea party in St. Patrick's Church Hall for Mr. Hector Emanuele. The purpose of our meeting was to make this recording of some of his memories of his time as a detainee in Peel's Peveril Camp M. We start our recording with the Chairman of the Commissioners, Mr. Ray Harmer, welcoming him.
On behalf of the whole of Peel and the town of Peel, wish to welcome you back in happier times and we're so glad that you can make it here.
Thank you very much. If you're not careful, I shall begin to cry in a moment. Now, today is Tuesday, the 26th of April, and I'm trying to remember as much as I can, and I'm really overwhelmed by the reception that I've received today. I really didn't expect this at all. But I would like to say that my name is Ettore Emanuele. Ettore is the Italian equivalent of Hector. Oh. All my friends call me Hector. Obviously, it's easier to pronounce than Ettore, you know. So I'm quite happy about that. I was born in South Wales, 1920, of Italian parents. And they tell me, and I still, although I left Wales when I was 12 years old, they say I still have a slight Welsh accent.
Yeah.
I don't know, they tell me I also speak Italian with a Welsh accent. Now, my story is rather strange in a way, because as a young child, I spent most of my working life, or young life, working for my father's ice cream business. I pushed a hand cart around the streets until I was about 14, and worked in the local pottery firm for a while as a lodge boy until the family business started increasing, and I was involved with the family business, expanding it and so on. And then it came to my attention that the Italian government were offering a 3 months holiday to children of Italian parents in Rome, free of charge, all expenses paid. And I thought this was an excellent opportunity to have a good week, month's holiday, you know, on the cheap. Because I was always very interested in art and painting and culture of Italian society and literature. And I wanted to improve that aspect of my life. But I was in for a big surprise when I got there.
What age would you have been then?
I was 19 then. This was 1939, I think. And we ended up at this camp in Rome, just outside Rome, a place called Monte Sacro. And we were issued with rifles and uniforms, and we were made to drill and march up and down the local streets with a band in front of us. And it was totally abhorrent to me. I hated it. I was devastated, you know. I couldn't understand it at all. And one day they said to us, we're going to receive as guests a party of brown shirts, Hitler youths. And they arrived with their camp. And they all seemed to be the same height, all blonde haired, all wore brown shirts with a swastika. And it was frightening. Mm. Really frightening. But we never sort of, we Italians, we never sort of fraternized with them at all. We were like tramps according to them, you know. They were that smart, honestly. But then war was declared on the 3rd of September 1939. Consequently, the camp was disbanded, and we couldn't get back to the UK because all the frontiers were closed, and we were all on a group passport, so we couldn't make our way back to the UK at all. And the camp authority said, those of you that have got Italian relatives in Italy, we will give you a travelling warrant, but you must travel in your uniform. That was a bit of propaganda, obviously, you know, to your relatives. And I made my way up into the Apennines, where my uncle had got a farm, and I went there, spent about 6 to 8 weeks there, until such time as the frontiers were reopened again. And we made our way back to the UK. And immediately I was back in the UK. My parents were delighted, of course, because they'd been away for quite a while, and they were worried about me. And I immediately set to working in the family business until June the 10th, 1940. Italy decided to declare war on the Allies. And that very evening, on June the 10th, I was arrested by two plainclothes men from the local branch of the police. And they said to my mother, it's okay, we're just taking him for questioning. He'll be back shortly. But that was the last you saw of me for 2.5 years. And they, from there, they took me to Walton Prison in Liverpool. And as I've explained before, I can still remember the cell number D516, D block, 5th floor, cell number 16. And that part of the prison hadn't been used for since the days of the suffragettes. And it was full of pigeon mess everywhere. Felt absolutely filthy it was. And we were locked up practically all day, you know. And we used to have porridge in the morning, but served in horrible aluminium battered tins, and you had to have slopping out business and all that thing. It wasn't very nice at all. And then we were there for about 6 weeks, I think, during the bombing. We were there during the bombing as well. And then they would transfer us from camp to camp. First we went to Ascot camp in Ascot, which happened to be the winter quarters camp of Bertha Mills' circus, and we were housed there for several weeks. And they never told us where we were being moved to. From there we went to York racecourse camp. The camp was situated in the grandstands underneath very cramped quarters, and we seemed to be living on boiled rice there, with the occasional smell of Terry's chocolate from across the road. And from there we went to Highton, which was a partly built housing estate in Liverpool. And there we were suffered with bombing and shrapnel. And then all sorts of rumours were floating around. We were going to be shot. We were going to be sent to Canada. We were going to be sent to Australia, you know. These rumours kept, you know, so circulating. We were getting worried. And then they decided that we were going to the Isle of Man. I thought, oh, that sounds pretty good, you know. I remember, I think it must have been Fleetwood that we left from. I can't remember. But we came on the Lady of Man, a boat called the Lady of Man. And we were escorted all the way across the channel by a naval frigate, I think it was. And I thought, that's strange, you know. Why do we need an escort, sort of thing? And, but apparently it was a thing to do in those days. And we landed at Douglas, and then we were transferred by train to Peel. And I really loved it. I must say, although I was a detainee, I thought, this is it, you know. We were, for the first time, we were humanely treated. Yes. And we were housed in the, what I've since heard, are called the Red Houses, which yes. is a group of Victorian guest houses along the promenade. And we were all allocated, about 14 or 15, to a house, sort of thing. Yes. We were allocated with rations. We made our own cooking arrangements and cleaning. And we set up house virtually, you know. And I really enjoyed it there, because for the first time in my life, I was able to concentrate on reading things that I'd never had time to read before. I wrote poetry, I painted sunsets of the St. Patrick's Isle across the bay, and we used to sit up on the grass bank at the back of the houses with a fellow detainee called Dominic Rea, and he was a gifted accordionist. He came from Manchester, and it was said that he was the Rudolph Valentino Manchester, if you can remember Rudolph Valentino.
Yes.
And he could simply compose a tune as he went, ask him to play a waltz, and he'd play something, he'd make it up as he went along. And I've often wondered then if the people in Peel could have heard us singing and playing while we were up on there, you know. And I've often wondered whether people ever remembered that. And I must say, I really enjoyed it. It was like a holiday camp, honestly. It was. And I used to dig the garden and wash clothes, and I got involved with the drama group, and I painted the scenery for several shows that we put on at the Albert Hall. And the military used to take us out in the morning, escort us to the Albert Hall, out of the camp, and we'd be there nearly all day messing about, making props, and men would be dressing up with paper bras and playing the part of females, you know. And we had great fun. And I remember designing two torches in relief for each side of the stage for the Albert Hall, and with HH. A.H. on Albert Hall. But I believe now it's no longer there. It's
Empire Garage.
Garage. I always remember that with affection, yeah. And today has been really remarkable, you know, brought it all back to me. Mm-hmm. I can't thank you enough, honestly.
No.
I feel as if I'm a son of Peel, you know. If there's any questions...
Well, I was going to ask you, you mentioned in your book about the tunnel, the escape tunnel.
Oh, yes, that's right, yeah. While I was there, obviously, I think they were either two or three Irish detainees who had got IRA sensibilities, you know,
yes.
And apparently they, from one of the houses at the top of the camp, they tunnelled out onto the road.
Mm.
And they stole a rowing boat, apparently. And they tried to get across to Ireland. we Italians, we knew nothing about this at all. Obviously, it was kept very secret, you know, this tunneling.
Well, we all knew about that, didn't we?
Yes,
we knew.
Did you know about
this? Yes.
You did?
Yes. It went from number 15, 17 Pebble Road.
That's it, on the left-hand side.
Yes.
Yeah.
Across the road and came up in the gardens of the large house there.
Somebody mentioned the fact that they used to go out at night and come back in time for roll call in the morning.
I don't know about that. I don't recall that
they
story.
They were caught anyway.
But they were certainly went out, tried to get off on their own board.
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
Yes.
And got nowhere, of course.
Yeah.
And
they were brought back to the camp. They didn't bring them back to the camp, apparently. They took them somewhere else, and it caused a bit of a riot, I believe, in the camp. I remember that. Because there was a lot of damage done to the Craigmallin. Hurling stones and things over the wire. Because
the rumour went round that
they'd been mistreated while they were captured. I don't know whether it was true or not, you know.
Well, the riots caused the Metropolitan Police to come.
Yes, there's a riot.
Commander Ralph.
the Metropolitan Police came and took charge, and things absolutely improved immensely when they came. In fact, he used to visit us in the camp, the commander.
Ralph.
Yes, yeah. And I remember, yes, I remember that very well.
So how long were you in Peel?
It must have been about 18 months, I would imagine. Yeah. Because when I was released, not from the camp from Peel, but from Brixton Prison, they sent me to Brixton Prison to await the result of a tribunal that I'd written. You know, my parish priest had written a letter of recommendation for me, you know, telling them what a good lad I was and all that sort of thing. And I think it had a lot of effect. But when I got to this tribunal, there were three men on the table, and I think they were MI5 or MI6 or something. I didn't know it at the time, but the man in the middle was named Blunt. He was the keeper of the Queen's pictures, I believe.
Yeah. Anthony.
Anthony Blunt.
Anthony Blunt. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody from the BBC told me this. He researched it, and he said it was. And it was sardonic because he was a spy for the Russians.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was interrogating about our fidelity to the British crown, you know. And it was, I didn't realise it at the time. And he said, we've had a letter from your parish priest. He's Irish, isn't he? As if to say, you know,
sympathetic,
yeah, you know. I said, yes, he is, you know.
And well, then Blunt was actually a spy for Russia, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I waited in Brixton Prison for about 2 or 3 weeks for the result, and then I got the result. A letter from the Home Office to say to the effect that we have decided that your detention is to be suspended. And I've wondered about that since, because that's not the same as saying you'll be released. I'm still in suspense, really. Yeah. I could be called back to that. Man.
I'd like to say to you that while you've come back.
Wow.
Were your parents in the internment camps during the war?
No. My mother and father had never been naturalised, and the family at Tunstall, where we lived, was very well respected. We were very well known. And they had not a bit of trouble with hostility or breaking windows or anything. And they were, the only thing that happened to my father, they took away the rotor arm from his car. He wasn't allowed to own a car during the period of the war. And that was all the trouble they had, you know. And my brother, he was 15 months younger than I. He served in the British Army, in the 8th Army, and he served through the African and the Italian campaign.
Goodness,
man. And I thought I was locked up.
Yeah.
So it was because of your month's holiday in Italy?
It was all due to that holiday that I took, you know. I don't know whether it was a lucky thing in a way that I took it, because I never went into any danger in the war. You know, it was fate in a way, wasn't it? It was like a guardian angel in a way. And when I was released, I went to I wanted to join the Royal Air Force. And the manager of the Labour Exchange says, oh no, they won't have you, he says. I've been directed, he said, by the Ministry of Labour, I think he said, to tell you that you were going to be directed labour. You were going to be sent to work as a trainee chef at the Arden Hotel in Birmingham. And that's what I did.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah, so even then I wasn't a free man, you know. Mm. I was directed, you'll go.
Yeah. It shows you how strange things happen.
Yes, yes. I don't have any bitterness at all about it, because I consider I've had a very lucky life in a way, you know.
You say about your brother being the 8th Army.
Yeah.
The Manx Regiment were with the 8th Army, and Corrie's father was actually with the 8th Army and went all the way through Africa and Italy.
Through Italy and into Germany.
Fantastic.
So your brother was serving with Manxmen out there, wasn't
he? Yes, he was. Yeah.
While you were interned by them here.
That's fascinating, isn't it?
Yes.
So how did your family go from South Wales to Tunstall?
That's a story.
Sorry, is that just...
Yeah, well, in South Wales, we were in a place called Treorchy, famous for its male voice choir, you know.
Yeah.
My father had a shop in, a cafe in Treorchy, and one in Treherbert, which is the next town up the valley. And my mother was very friendly with a family called James. Mr. Tom James was a butcher, and his wife was, she was a Welsh lady, obviously. And my mother got very friendly with them. And Mrs. James taught my mother English virtually, taught how to speak. Eventually my mother, she could read English like, and she was a brilliant businesswoman. You wouldn't think so, would you? She could never be to school, and yet she was the brains of the family business. She was fantastic, really. And the James family left Wales during the Depression and came to Stoke-on-Trent, where Mr. James opened a butcher shop in Golden Hill, which perhaps you remember, you know, Golden Hill. And then, but in the meantime, my father thought things were bad in South Wales, trade was slacking off, miners were closing. He decided to try his luck in England, so he, for some reason, he went to Stratford-upon-Avon and opened a cafe there, and 1932, I think it was, and I went to school there for 2 years at William Shakespeare's school, apparently, King Edward VI Grammar School, and I hated it.
Did you?
Oh, I did. We didn't fit in at all, not in Stratford-upon-Avon. For one thing, my brother and I, we were both Catholics, and there were two brothers, they were two Jewish boys. They were the sons of Stratford-upon-Avon industrialists. They made, they canned peas and they had aluminium works. And we were, say, King Edward VII Grammar School was Church of England school, and the headmaster was a vicar, you know. And it was very, we were made to stand outside in the corridors when they had religious instruction. And, you know, it was racism in a way, wasn't it?
Yes.
And we didn't fit in at all, you know. We didn't fit in at all. And so after 2 years, my father decided to follow the James family to Stoke-on-Trent.
Wow.
And that's what we did.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Mm. Were you ever in contact with any of the local people while you were over here?
You mean?
While you were in the camp, did you ever in contact with any of the Peel people?
No. But when my mother visited me in 1941, I was 21. I had my 21st birthday in the camp. And she stayed in a boarding house in, I think it was Mona Street in Douglas. And the landlady there used to send me food parcels. And I've often wondered, I wish I'd known her name, you know. I would have loved to have thanked her. But it was lost, you know, my mother never told me, and it's all gone now, of course, can't trace it now. And it was very nice, that was, because although the rations were quite adequate in the camp, we got these food parcels, and one or two of the enterprising detainees started to open a little cafe.
you wouldn't believe it, would you?
Practice their arts and cooking again, you know.
Did you get to see anywhere else in the town apart from the theatre? Did you
go
to the church or anything like that?
I think I can just remember the church. But they did take us out on walks. And I remember we went on to St. Patrick's Isle once. And that was very nice. Mm-hmm. It is St. Patrick's Isle.
Yes. So were there many... I mean, the Peveril camp was called the fascist camp, wasn't it? Were there...
It was considered to be, yes, it was a detainee camp as opposed to an internment camp, I think.
Right.
Because they said that the people that came to Peveril camp had got fascist sympathies.
Right.
Or they were members of the fascist party of some way or the other.
Yeah.
But lots of these Italians, you know, they would be members of the fascist party as if they were members of the conservative party. It meant nothing to them, you know. It was just a social thing, you know.
Yes.
But, so I was considered to be a danger to the country, you know.
I've come through from Auckland.
Onken,
afternoon.
Yes.
Onken is over by Douglas.
Yes, yes.
And in Onken there was a large camp there.
Yeah.
And in one of the houses there were five priests and one lay brother.
Yes.
And the other internees nicknamed it the Vatican.
Yeah.
But close by to the Onken camp was the Catholic Church.
Yes.
And after a while, permission was granted for the Catholics. On a Sunday, they would line up and march to the church, and they would hear Mass along with the Onken people, except they were on one side of the church, and the Onken people were on the other.
Yeah.
And I have the notebooks that the priest wrote in for his notices each week.
Yes.
And every so often he would remind the local people that they weren't to speak to the internees, because if they did, they would lose the privilege of coming to Mass.
Oh.
Now, did you have any priests in the Peel camp or not?
I think there were, yes. Right. Yeah. I can't say definitely,
no.
But we did have one. He was the priest, but his name was Sperny. Sperny. He was the mayor of St. Pancras. He was a freeman of the City of London, a magistrate, and goodness knows what else. He was a benefactor, and he was interned. And he was very bitter. I know he was very, bitter about it.
Well, he wasn't in charge anymore.
No.
So, when you said you can remember the church, were you allowed to come to the church, or was that just occasionally? Or
you know, my memory is a bit dim, but the church does strike a bell, because I was saying earlier on that while I was in the camp, I designed an altarpiece,
right,
an altar front for the church.
Mm.
So I must have been in the church sometime.
Yeah.
It was in three panels. It was rather colourful, I must admit, you know. And got IHS in the middle, you know.
Yes.
And whether I intended it to give to the priest or what, I can't remember now. I can't make it, I don't want to make things up, you know.
No.
But I know I designed that.
And when you were in the camp, did you play tennis?
I played tennis, yes.
Did you play with Tiny Rowland? Was he there then?
Oh, no.
No, he wasn't there then.
I know I played tennis, and I wrote poetry, and I painted watercolours, and... Oh, yes, yeah.
Did you ever get an ice cream when you were in there?
I tell you what I did do when I designed an ice cream. Planned for an ice cream factory. and an ice cream wrap.
George David.
This, in 1950, this came to fruition, because we did have an ice cream factory in 1950 at Biddulph, which is, and it followed almost exactly what I'd planned out in my mind while I was interned.
That's amazing.
So there's no shortage of paint and paper here, do you?
No, I didn't have any problem, but somehow, I don't know. We didn't seem to be handicapped in any way, you know.
And one of the things you'd done later in life was to have an audience with the Pope, I believe.
Oh, yeah. That was on my honeymoon. Yes. Pope Pius XI, I think he was.
Gosh.
At Rome, yeah.
So the Pope at one visit, and then the Chairman of the Commissioners at the next visit.
Yes,
that's it.
Yeah.
I think I've had a charmed life, really.
Wonderful memory.
Your art material, did your parents send that to you?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. And censorship, parceled, everything was opened up first, was it?
I think it must have been. We were allowed to write letters, you know, home. I wrote quite a lot, I think. It's in my diary, you did.
Yes.
Could you sense that the local people in Peel were antagonistic towards
No, I don't
the
think they did, really, no.
There wasn't any abuse?
No, there was nothing like no catcalling, nothing like that over the wire or things like that, you know.
Go on.
It was
sympathetic. Yeah.
Yeah. But there wasn't very little,
No.
No, there wasn't in Douglas either. I have spoken to people who have died now who had to get out of their boarding houses at 48 hours notice, only allowed to take a plate and a spoon and a fork and knife each. And there was somebody with me, and they were interviewing them, and they said, well, did you feel antagonistic against these people being in your house? And quite surprisingly to me, they said, no, we didn't. No. Because we were able to walk out of our house and go and stay with grandmother or auntie or whatever. Yeah. They had been taken out of their house and put there and
that's couldn't
see the relations or whatever. Yeah. Mm. So they did actually feel sorry for the internees, as opposed to what you would expect, that they were very concerned that they'd been pushed out of their house.
Yeah.
We had 6 weeks' notice to get out of Peveril Terrace.
Well, it's Peel.
Is that what it's got? Is that
six.
Well,
6 weeks. They didn't help.
Weeks,
Nobody helped. You had to go and
you
leave
had to make
places.
Did you?
So
yes.
No compensation, no help or anything.
No.
So it was a bit of a problem. I think they were a bit antagonistic towards the people who put, not the people who gone in the camp, the ones who said out 6 weeks end up.
So was there anybody else from your hometown?
No, I was the only one.
You were the only one. So you made new friends.
I made new friends, yes. In fact, if whenever one would get released occasionally, the people would cry. Because we were like a family, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. They weren't, they'd cry. Yeah.
Have you met them since you've left? Mm-hmm. The people from the camp? The people that you met at the camp?
Yeah.
Have you met them since?
No, no. And it's always amazed me that there's never been any sort of a reunion.
Oh, right.
It's amazing, you know. Yeah. People just don't want to remember. I don't know what it is, but I would have thought that there would have been some sort of a, you know, get together and remember, but there's never been anything like that. Yeah.
Well, you might get rounded up again if you did that.
And it's amazed me. Recently, I went down to South Wales. All the Italians down in South Wales, there's lots of them, you know. They have an annual dinner, you know, in one of the nice hotels, and they invited me down, you know, as a sort of guest of honour in a way, because of this book, and I expected it to be really a real Italian meal, you know, but when I got there, we had roast beef, you know, and it was Christmas time, it was singing English carols. And there was a stage where the dragon flag, you know, the Welsh flag, and the Italian flag. And there wasn't a bit of Italian atmosphere at all. They were more Welsh than Italian, because they've integrated into
so
the community,
much,
you know.
Yes.
Yeah, and you find this, I think, with Italians. They do integrate, and they speak more like in Scotland, they speak rather like Scottish people. Yeah. Whereas with the Asian communities, you don't get that, do you?
No, not so much.
Why were there so many Italian families in Wales? I mean, in London, yes, because a lot worked in the restaurants, but
yeah.
Were they miners in Wales? Or
No. It's strange, that is, because the first immigrant who came to South Wales was named Bracci. Bracci. And for some reason he settled in South Wales. And then what would happen? He would send for his relatives, his brothers, and they would follow each other until the community grew. And every cafe in South Wales in those days, it doesn't matter what the surname was, it was called a Bracci shop. It's a Bracci shop. And it's still there today. My father came over with a Bracci. He was sponsored by a Bracci. And he settled in Abercorn when I was born. And it's, it's grown like that.
Remarkable.
Yeah. In fact, one of these Italians from South Wales is that actor called Victor Spinetti.
Mm-hmm.
He was from Bardi, from my hometown. And the Sidolis, they played rugby for Wales. Yeah.
And the ice cream factory you designed?
Yeah.
Is it still there?
No, oh no, we went into liquidation.
Somebody turned the freezer on.
Yeah.
A victim of walls.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we went to liquidation in 1966, I think it was, or 68, I forget now. With fierce competition from Lion's Maid and Vauxhall's, We were supplying at one time all the local cinemas, a group of local cinemas, and all the shops and so on. And of course, the big firms came along and gave us free refrigerators and free advertising, and also we couldn't compete.
A bit like Tesco's taking over.
True.
Yeah.
And supermarkets, of course, you could buy ice cream anywhere,
Before your father came to Wales,
what
did he do in Italy?
He was just a farmer.
Right. So he went from farmer to caterer.
My father was actually born in Paris. His father emigrated from our hometown in Italy to Paris, and he worked, we believe, in Paris, where they built barrel organs and fairground music. And my son's been researching on the census returns and so on. And we come across people from Bardi, occupation organist. I thought, we've got musical people in the family, but it's not true. They were barrel organists.
That's nice.
So what does the younger generation of your family feel about the fact that you were interned in that?
The younger generation?
Yes. What do they feel about that?
I don't know. They're more English than anything now, my children,
Yes.
Well, I've got a daughter in Saudi Arabia, a daughter in Caerphilly, South Wales, a son in Germany, and two sons at home, virtually at home, And they're all different, They don't speak any Italian.
No.
Well, myself, I had to go to night school to learn Italian. my parents spoke a real broad Italian dialect at home, which is a very broad Italian dialect.
Yeah.
But whenever we had Italian visitors or relatives, they always put on the posh Italian, like Queen's English. And I thought to myself, I must learn this. So I took lessons on the radio and postal courses, and then I said, I must learn my mother tongue, So I went to night school at home, and I got an O-level and an A-level. And that's the only qualifications I've got. I left good at 13 and a half.
And have you got anybody to speak to?
No.
In Italian?
No. But when I do go to Italy on holidays now, I'm a keen rambler, you know, and I've taken parties of about 20 on walking holidays in the past to Italy, Austria and Portugal, and I've always been in demand as an interpreter, you know. They go into a cafe and they don't know what they want, and they come to me, you know, and say, what's this and what's that, you know. And I enjoyed doing that because it gave me a chance to practice my Italian. But I always like to talk to the ladies, you know, because they call me the Casanova of France.
You were not telling Peel to, yeah, obviously.
Because I must admit, I love talking to ladies, you know.
We can go.
We better go then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember I was on honeymoon actually in Florence, and I was standing on the Ponte Vecchio, you know it. It's full of jeweler shops and silversmiths, and there were two young ladies looking in the window, and they spoke perfect Tuscan Italian, and they were comparing prices, and I thought to myself, that's fantastic, I must learn to speak like that, you know. And it, ever since then, I've listened to ladies talking, you know.
Yeah.
We should make them an honorary monksman, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
We should make you an honorary monksman.
Oh, I'd love that. I really would.